never intimidated Gentry. Gentry didn't seem to know or care that he could be hurt. That was intimidating in its own way. Gentry had slapped him once hard in the face, and Slick had looked down at the huge chrome Molly wrench in his own hand and had felt an obscure embarrassment. Gentry was holding himself rigid, starting to tremble. Slick had a pretty good idea that Gentry didn't sleep when he went to Boston or New York. He didn't always sleep that much in factory, either. Come back strung, and the first day was always the worst.
"Look," Slick said,
the way somebody might to a child on the verge of tears, and pulled the bag from his pocket, the bribe from Kid Africa. He held up the clear plastic ziplock for Gentry to see. Blue derms, pink tablets, a nasty-looking turd of opium in a twist of red cellophane, crystals of whiz like fat yellow throat lozenges, plastic inhalers with the Japanese manufacturer's name scraped off with a knife. "From Africa," Slick said, dangling the ziplock.
"Africa?"
Gentry looked at the bag, at Slick, the bag again.
"From Africa?"
"Kid Africa. You don't know him. Left this for you."
"Why?"
"Because he needs me to put up these friends of his for a little while. I owe him a favor, Gentry. Told him how you didn't like anybody around, how it gets in your way. So," Slick lied, "he said he wanted to leave you some stuff to make up for the trouble." Gentry took the bag and slid his finger along the seal, opening it. He took out the opium and handed that back to Slick.
"Won't need that."
Took out one of the blue derms, peeling off the backing, and smoothed it carefully into place on the inside of his right wrist. Slick stood there, absently kneading the opium between his thumb and forefinger, making the cellophane crackle, while Gentry walked back around the long table and opened the pannier. He pulled out a new pair of black leather gloves.
"I think I'd better meet these guests of yours, Slick."
"Huh?" Slick blinked, astonished.
"Yeah, but you don't really have to. I mean, wouldn't it be..."
"No," Gentry said, flicking up his collar.
"I insist."
Going down the stairs, Slick remembered the opium and flung it over the rail into the dark. He hated drugs.
"Cherry?"
He felt stupid, with Gentry watching him bang his knuckles on his own door. No answer. He opened it. Dim light. He saw how she'd made a shade for one of his bulbs, a cone of yellow fax fastened with a twist of wire. She'd unscrewed the other two. She wasn't there. The stretcher was there, its occupant bundled in the blue nylon bag.
"It's eating him,"
Slick thought, as he looked at the superstructure of support gear, the tubes, the sacks of fluid.
"No,"
he told himself.
"It's keeping him alive, like in a hospital."
But the impression lingered. What if it were draining him dry? He remembered Bird's vampire talk.
"Well,"
said Gentry, stepping past him to stand at the foot of the stretcher.
"Strange company you keep, Slick Henry."
Gentry walked around the stretcher, keeping a cautious meter between his ankles and the still figure.
"Gentry, you sure you maybe don't want to go back up? I think that derm, maybe you did too much."
"Really?"
Gentry cocked his head, his eyes glittering in the yellow glow. He winked.
Why do you think that?
Well,
Slick hesitated.
You aren't like you usually are. I mean, like you were before. You think I'm experiencing a mood swing, Slick?
Yeah.
I'm enjoying a mood swing.
I don't see you smiling, Cherry said from the door.
This is Gentry Cherry. Factory is sort of his place. Cherry's from Cleveland.
But Gentry had a thin black flashlight in his gloved hand. He was examining the trode net that covered the sleeper's forehead. He straightened up, the beam finding the featureless, unmarked unit, then darting down again to follow the black cable to the trode net.
Cleveland,
Gentry said at last, as though it were a name he'd heard in a dream.
Interesting.
He raised his light again, craning forward to peer at the point where the cable joined the unit.
And Cherry? Cherry? Who is he?
The beam falling hard on the wasted, irritatingly ordinary face. Don't know, Cherry said. Get that out of his eyes. Might screw up his REM or something.
And this?
He lit the flat gray package. The LF kid called it. Called him the Count, called that his LF. She thrust her hand inside her jackets and scratched herself.
Well then,
Gentry said, turning. Click as the beam died, the light of his obsession burning bright. Bright behind his eyes, amplified so powerfully by Kid Africa's derm that it seemed to Slick that the shape must be right there, blazing through Gentry's forehead, for anyone at all to see except Gentry himself.
That must be just what it is.
Chapter 11. Down on the drag. Mona woke as they were landing. Pryor was listening to Eddie and nodding and flashing his rectangular smile. It was like the smile was always there behind his beard. He'd changed his clothes, though, so he must have had some on the plane. Now he wore a plain gray business suit and a tie with diagonal stripes, sort of like the tricks Eddie'd set her up with in Cleveland, except the suit fit a different way. She'd seen a trick fitted for a suit once, a guy who took her to a Holiday Inn. The suit place was off the hotel lobby, and he stood in there in his underwear, cross-hatched with lines of blue light, and watched himself on three big screens. On the screens you couldn't see the blue lines, because he was wearing a different suit in each image. And Mona had to bite her tongue to keep from laughing, because the system had a cosmetic program that made him look different on the screens, stretched his face a little and made his chin stronger, and he didn't seem to notice. Then he picked a suit, got back into the one he'd been wearing, and that was it. Eddie was explaining something to Pryor, some crucial point in the architecture of one of his scams. She knew how to tune the content out, but the tone still got to her. Like he knew people wouldn't be able to grasp the gimmick he was so proud of, so he was taking it slow and easy, like he was talking to a little kid, and he'd keep his voice low to sound patient. It didn't seem to bother Pryor, but then it seemed to Mona that Pryor didn't much give a shit what Eddie said. She yawned, stretched, and the plane bumped twice on runway concrete, roared, began to slow. Eddie hadn't even stopped talking.
We have a car waiting,
Pryor said, interrupting him.
So where is it taking us?
Mona asked, ignoring Eddie's frown. Pryor showed her the smile.
To our hotel.
He unfastened his seatbelt.
We'll be there for a few days. Afraid you'll have to spend most of them in your room.
That's the deal, Eddie said, like it was his idea she'd have to stay in the room.
"You like stims, Mona?" Pryor asked, still smiling.
"Sure," she said. "Who doesn't?"
"Have a favorite, Mona, a favorite star?"
"Angie,"
she said, vaguely irritated.
"Who else?"
The smile got a little bigger.
"Good. We'll get you all of her latest tapes."
Mona's universe consisted in large part of things and places she knew, but had never physically seen or visited. The hub of the northern sprawl didn't smell in stims. They edited it out, she guessed, the way Angie never had a headache or a bad period. But it did smell. Like Cleveland, but even worse. She'd thought it was just the way the airport smelled when they left the plane, but it had been even stronger when they'd gotten out of their car to go into the hotel. And it was cold as hell in the street, too, with a wind that bit at her bare ankles. The hotel was bigger than that Holiday Inn, but older, too, she thought. The lobby was more crowded than lobbies were in stims. But there was a lot of clean blue carpet. Pryor made her wait by an ad for an orbital spa, while he and Eddie went over to a long black counter, and he talked to a woman with a brass name tag. She felt stupid waiting there, in this white plastic raincoat Pryor had made her wear. Like he didn't think her outfit was good enough. About a third of the crowd in the lobby were Japs, she figured for tourists. They all seemed to have recording gear of some kind, video, holo, a few with SimStim units on their belts, but otherwise, they didn't look like they had a whole lot of money. She thought they were all supposed to have a lot.
"Maybe they're smart. Don't want to show it," she decided.
She saw Pryor slide a credit chip across the counter to the woman with the name tag, who took it and zipped it along a metal slot. Pryor put her bag down on the bed, a wide slab of beige temper foam, and touched a panel that caused a wall of drapes to open.
"It's not the Ritz," he said. "But we'll try to make you comfortable."
Mona made a noncommittal sound. The Ritz was a burger place in Cleveland, and she couldn't see what that had to do with anything.
"Look," he said. "Your favorite."
He was standing beside the bed's upholstered headboard. There was a stim unit there, built in, and a little shelf, with a set of trodes in a plastic wrapper, and about 5 cassettes.
All of Angie's new stims.
She wondered who'd put those cassettes there, and if they'd done it after Pryor had asked her what stims she liked. She showed him a smile of her own and went to the window. The sprawl looked like it did in stims. The window was like a hologram postcard. Famous buildings she didn't know the names of, but she knew they were famous. Gray of the domes, geodesics picked out white with snow. Behind that, the gray of the sky.
"Happy baby?"
Eddie asked, coming up behind her and putting his hands on her shoulders.
"They got showers here?"
Pryor laughed. She shrugged out of Eddie's loose grip and took her bag into the bathroom, closed and locked the door. She heard Pryor's laugh again, and Eddie starting up with his scam talk. She sat on the toilet, opened her bag, and dug out the cosmetic kit where she kept her whiz. She had 4 crystals left. That seemed like enough. 3 was enough. But when she got down to 2, she usually started looking to score. She didn't do jumpers much, not every day anyway, except recently she had. But that was because Florida had started to drive her crazy. Now she could start tapering off, she decided, as she tapped a crystal out of the vial. It looked like hard yellow candy. You had to crush it, then grind it up between a pair of nylon screens. When you did that, it gave off a kind of hospital smell. They were both gone by the time she finished her shower. She stayed in until she got bored with it, which took a long time. In Florida, she'd mostly used showers at public pools or bus stations, the kind you worked with tokens. She guessed there was something hooked up to this one that measured the liters and put it on your bill. That was how it worked at the Holiday Inn. There was a big white filter above the plastic showerhead, and a sticker on the tile wall with an eye and a tear meant it was okay to shower, but don't get it in your eyes like swimming pool water. There was a row of chrome spouts set into the tile, and when you punched a button under each one, you got shampoo, shower gel, liquid soap, bath oil. When you did that, a little red dot lit up beside the button, because it went on your bill. On Pryor's bill. She was glad they were gone, because she liked being alone, and high, and clean. She didn't get to be alone much, except on the street, and that wasn't the same. She left damp footprints on the beige carpet when she walked to the window. She was wrapped in a big towel that matched the bed and the carpet, and had a word shaved into the fuzzy part, probably the name of the hotel. There was an old-fashioned building a block away, and the corners of its stepped peak had been carved down to make a kind of mountain, with rocks and grass, and a waterfall that fell and hit rocks and then fell again. It made her smile. Why anybody had gone to that trouble. Drifts of steam came off the water where it hit. It couldn't just fall down into the street, though, she thought, because it would cost too much. She guessed they pumped it back up and used it over around in a circle. Something gray moved its head there, swung its big curly horns up like it was looking at her. She took a step back on the carpet and blinked. Kind of a sheep. But it had to be a remote. A hologram or something. It tossed its head and started eating grass. Mona laughed. She could feel the whiz down the backs of her ankles and across her shoulder blades, a cold, tight tingle, and the hospital smell at the back of her throat. She'd been scared before, but she wasn't scared now. Pryor had a bad smile, but he was just a player, just a bent suit. If he had money, it was somebody else's. And she wasn't scared of Eddie anymore. It was almost like she was scared for him, because she could see what other people took him for. Well, she thought it didn't matter. She wasn't growing catfish in Cleveland anymore. And no way anybody'd get her back to Florida again. She remembered the alcohol stove, cold winter mornings, the old man hunched in his big gray coat. Winters he'd put a second layer of plastic over the windows. The stove was enough to heat the place then, because the walls were covered with sheets of hard foam and chipboard over that. Places where the foam showed, you could pick at it with your finger, make holes. If he caught you doing it, he'd yell. Keeping the fish warm in cold weather was more work. You had to pump water up to the roof, where the sun mirrors were, in these clear plastic tubes. But the vegetable stuff rotting on the tank ledges helped too. Steam rose off when you went to net a fish. He traded the fish for other kinds of food, for things people grew, stove alcohol, and the drinking kind, coffee beans, garbage the fish ate. He wasn't her father, and he'd said it often enough, when he'd talked at all. Sometimes she still wondered if maybe he had been. When she'd first asked him how old he was, he'd said 6. So she counted from that. She heard the door open behind her and turned. Pryor was there. The gold plastic key tab in his hand, beard open to show the smile.
Mona, he said, stepping in. This is Gerald.
Tall, Chinese, gray suit, graying hair. Gerald smiled gently, edged in past Pryor, and went straight for the drawer thing opposite the foot of the bed. Put a black case down and clicked it open.
Gerald's a friend. He's medical Gerald. Needs to have a look at you.
Mona, Gerald said, removing something from the case. How old are you?
She's 16, Pryor said. Right, Mona?
16, Gerald said. The thing in his hands was like a pair of black goggles, sunglasses with bumps and wires. That's stretching it a little, isn't it? He looked at Pryor. Pryor smiled. You're short, what, 10 years?
Not quite, Pryor said. We aren't asking for perfection.
Gerald looked at her. You aren't going to get it. He hooked the goggles over his ears and tapped something. A light came on below the right lens.
But there are degrees of approximation.
The light swung toward her.
We're talking cosmetic, Gerald.
Where's Eddie?
She asked as Gerald came closer.
In the bar. Shall I call him?
Pryor picked up the phone, but put it back down without using it.
What is this?
Backing away from Gerald.
A medical examination,
Gerald said.
Nothing painful.
He had her against the window. Above the towel, her shoulder blades pressed against cool glass.
Someone's about to employ you and pay you very well. They need to be certain you're in good health.
The light stabbed into her left eye. She's on stimulants of some kind, he said to Pryor in a different tone of voice. Try not to blink, Mona. The light swung to her right eye.
What is it, Mona?
How much did you do?
Whiz.
Wincing away from the light. He caught her chin in his cool fingers and realigned her head.
How much?
A crystal.
The light was gone. His smooth face was very close, the goggles studded with lenses, slots, little dishes of black metal mesh.
No way of judging the purity, he said.
It's real pure,
she said and giggled. He let her chin go and smiled.
It shouldn't be a problem, he said. Could you open your mouth, please?
Mouth?
I want to look at your teeth.
She looked at Pryor. You're in luck here, Gerald said to Pryor when he used the little light to look in her mouth.
Fairly good condition and close to target configuration. Caps, inlays. We knew we could count on you, Gerald.
Gerald took the goggles off and looked at Pryor. He returned to the black case and put the goggles away.
Lucky with the eyes, too. Very close.
A tint job. He took a foil envelope from the case and tore it open. Rolled the pale surgical glove down over his right hand.
Take off the towel, Mona. Make yourself comfortable.
She looked at Pryor. At Gerald.
You wanna see my papers? The blood work and stuff?
No,
Gerald said.
That's fine.
She looked out the window, hoping to see the bighorn, but it was gone, and the sky seemed a lot darker. She undid the towel, let it fall to the floor, then lay down on her back on the beige temper foam. It wasn't all that different from what she got paid for. It didn't even take as long. Sitting in the bathroom, with the cosmetic kit open on her knees, grinding another crystal, she decided she had a right to be pissed off. First Eddie takes off without her. Then Pryor shows up with this creep medic. Then he tells her Eddie's sleeping in a different room. Back in Florida, she could have used some time off from Eddie. But up here was different. She didn't want to be in here by herself. And she'd been scared to ask Pryor for a key. He fucking well had one, though. So he could walk in any time with his creep-ass friends. What kind of deal was that? And the business with the plastic raincoat, that burned her ass, too. A disposable fucking plastic raincoat. She fluffed the powdered whiz between the nylon screens, carefully tapped it into the hitter, exhaled hard, put the mouthpiece to her lips, and hit. The cloud of yellow dust coated the membranes of her throat. Some of it probably even made it to her lungs. She heard that was bad for you. She hadn't had any plan when she'd gone in the bathroom to take her hit, but as the back of her neck started tingling, she found herself thinking about the streets around the hotel, what she'd seen on them on their way in. There were clubs, bars, shops with clothes in the window. Music. Music would be okay now, and a crowd. The way you could lose it in a crowd, forget yourself, just be there. The door wasn't locked, she knew that. She already tried it. It would lock behind her, though, and she didn't have a key. But she was staying here, so Pryor must have registered her at the desk. She thought about going down and asking the woman behind the counter for a key, but the idea made her uncomfortable. She knew suits behind counters and how they looked at you. No, she decided. The best idea was to stay in and stim those new Angies. 10 minutes later, she was on her way out a side entrance off the main lobby, the whiz singing in her head. It was drizzling outside, maybe dome condensation. She'd worn the white raincoat for the lobby, figuring Pryor knew what he was doing after all, but now she was glad she had it. She grabbed a fold of fax out of an overflowing bin and held it over her head to keep her hair dry. It wasn't as cold as before, which was another good thing. None of her new clothes were what you'd call warm. Looking up and down the avenue, deciding which way to go, she took in half a dozen nearly identical hotel fronts. A rank of pedicabs, the rain-slick glitter of a row of small shops. And people. Lots of them. Like the Cleveland Corps, but everybody dressed so sharp and all moving like they were on top of it. Everybody with some place to go. Just go with it, she thought. The whiz giving her a sweet second boot that tripped her into the river of pretty people without even having to think about it. Clicking along in her new shoes, holding the fax over her head until she noticed more luck. The rain had stopped. She wouldn't have minded a chance to check out the shop windows when the crowd swept her past. But the flow was pleasure, and nobody else was pausing. She contented herself with sidelong flashes of each display. The clothes were like clothes in a stim, some of them styles she'd never seen anywhere. I should have been here, she thought. I should have been here all along. Not on a catfish farm. Not in Cleveland. Not in Florida. It's a place. A real place. Anybody can come here. You don't have to get it through a stim. Thing was, she'd never seen this part of it in a stim. The regular people part. A star like Angie, this part wasn't her part. Angie'd be off in high castles with the other stim stars. Not down here. But God, it was pretty. The night so bright. The crowd surging around her. Past all the good things you could have if you just got lucky. Eddie, he didn't like it. Anyway, he'd always said how it was shitty here. Too crowded, rent too high, too many police, too much competition. Not that he'd waited 2 seconds when Pryor had made an offer, she reminded herself. And anyway, she had her own ideas why Eddie was so down on it. He'd blown it here, she figured, pulled some kind of serious Wilson. Either he didn't want to be reminded, or else there were people here who'd remind him for sure if he came back. It was there in the pissed-off way he talked about the place. Same way he'd talk about anybody who told him his scams wouldn't work. The new buddy, so goddamn smart the first night, was just a stone Wilson the next. Dead stupid. No vision. Past a big store with ace-looking stim gear in the window, all of it matte black and skinny, presided over by this gorgeous hollow of Angie, who watched them all slide by with her half-sad smile. Queen of the night. Yeah. The crowd river flowed out into a kind of circle, a place where 4 streets met and swung around a fountain. And because Mona really wasn't headed anywhere, she wound up there, because the people around her peeled off in their different directions without stopping. Well, there were people in the circle, too. Some of them sitting on the cracked concrete that edged the fountain. There was a statue in the center, marble, all worn out and soft-edged. Kind of a baby riding a big fish, a dolphin. It looked like the dolphin's mouth would spray water if the fountain was working, but it wasn't. Past the heads of the seated people, she could see crumpled, sodden facts and white foam cups in the water. Then it seemed like the crowd had melded behind her, a curved, sliding wall of bodies. And the three who faced her on the fountain rim jumped out like a picture. Fat girl with black-dyed hair, mouth half open, like it stayed that way, tits spilling out of a red rubber halter. Blonde with a long face and a thin blue slash of lipstick, hand like a bird's claw sprouting a cigarette. Man with his oiled arms bare to the cold, graft job muscle knotted like rock under synthetic tan and bad jail tattoos.
"Hey, bitch," cried the fat girl with a kind of glee. "Hope you don't think you're gonna turn any round here."
The blonde looked at Mona with her tired eyes and gave her a wan grin. "And it's not my fault," grin, and then looked away. The pimp came up off the fountain like something driven by springs, but Mona was already moving, cued by the blonde's expression. He had her arm, but the raincoat's plastic seam gave way, and she elbowed her way back into the crowd. The whiz took over, and the next thing she knew, she was at least a block away, sagging against a steel pole, coughing and hyperventilating. But now, the whiz was all turned around, the way it went sometimes, and everything was ugly. The faces in the crowd were driven and hungry-looking, like they all had their own private, desperate errands to run, and the light from the shop windows was cold and mean, and all the things behind the glass were just there to tell her she couldn't have them. There was a voice somewhere, an angry child's voice stringing obscenities together in an endless, meaningless chain. When she realized who it was, she stopped doing it. Her left arm was cold. She looked down and saw that the sleeve was gone, the seam down her side torn open to the waist. She took off the coat and draped it over her shoulders like a cape. Maybe that made it a little harder to notice. She braced her back against the pole as the whiz rolled over her on a wave of delayed adrenaline. Her knees started to buckle, and she thought she was going to faint. But then, the whiz pulled one of its tricks, and she was crouching in summer sunset light in the old man's dirt yard. The flaky gray earth scribed with the game she'd been playing, but now she was just hunched there, vacant, staring off past the bulks of the tanks to where fireflies pulsed in the blackberry tangle above a twisted old chassis. There was light behind her from the house, and she could smell the cornbread baking and the coffee he boiled and reboiled there. Till a spoon stood up in it, he said. And he'd be in there now reading one of his books. Crumbly brown leaves, never a page with a corner on it. He got them in frayed plastic baggies, and sometimes they just fell to dust in his hands. But if he found something he wanted to keep, he'd get a little pocket copier out of the drawer, fit the batteries in it, run it down the page. She liked to watch the copies spool out all fresh, with their special smell that faded away. But he'd never let her work it. Sometimes he'd read out loud, a kind of hesitation in his voice, like a man trying to play an instrument he hasn't picked up in a long time. They weren't stories he read. Not like they had endings or told a joke. They were like windows into something so strange. He never tried to explain any of it. Probably didn't understand it himself. Maybe nobody did. Then the street snapped back hard and bright. She rubbed her eyes and coughed. Chapter 12. Antarctica starts here.
I'm ready now, Piper Hill said.
Eyes closed, seated on the carpet in a loose approximation of the lotus position.
Touch the spread with your left hand.
Eight slender leads trailed from the sockets behind Piper's ears to the instrument that lay across her tanned thighs. Angie, wrapped in a white terry robe, faced the blonde technician from the edge of the bed, the black test unit covering her forehead like a raised blindfold. She did as she was told, running the tips of her fingers lightly across the raw silk and unbleached linen of the rumpled bedspread.
Good, Piper said, more to herself than to Angie, touching something on the board. Again?
Angie felt the weave thicken beneath her fingertips.
Again?
Another adjustment. She could distinguish the individual fibers now. No, silk from linen.
Again?
Her nerves screamed as her flayed fingertips grated against steel wool, ground glass.
Optimal,
Piper said, opening blue eyes. She produced a tiny ivory vial from the sleeve of her kimono, removed its stopper, passed the vial to Angie. Closing her eyes, Angie sniffed cautiously.
Nothing.
Again?
Something floral.
Violets?
Again?
Her head flooded with a nauseating greenhouse reek. All factories up? Piper said as the choking odor faded.
Haven't noticed.
She opened her eyes. Piper was offering her a tiny round of white paper.
As long as it's not fish,
Angie said, licking the tip of her finger. She touched the dot of paper, raised her finger to her tongue. One of Piper's tests had once put her off seafood for a month.
It's not fish,
Piper said, smiling. She kept her hair short, a concise little helmet that played up the graphite gleam of the sockets inset behind either ear. Saint Joan in silicone, Porfire said. And Piper's true passion seemed to be her work. She was Angie's personal technician, reputed to be the net's best troubleshooter.
Caramel.
Who else is here, Piper? Having completed the usher, Piper was zipping her board into a fitted nylon case. Angie had heard a helicopter arrive an hour earlier. She'd heard laughter, footsteps on the deck, as the dream receded. She'd abandoned her usual attempt to inventory sleep, if it could be called sleep, the others' memories washing in filling her, then draining away to levels she couldn't reach, leaving these after-images.
Rabel, Piper said.
Lomas, Hickman, Ing, Porfire, the Pope.
Robin?
No.
Continuity, she said, showering.
Good morning, Angie.
Freeside Taurus. Who owns it?
The Taurus has been renamed Mustique 2 by the current joint owners, the Juliana Group and Caribana Orbital.
Who owned it when Tally taped there?
Tessier Ashpool S.A.
I want to know more about Tessier Ashpool.
Antarctica starts here. She stared up through the steam at the white circle of the speaker.
What did you just say?
Antarctica starts here as a 2-hour video study of the Tessier Ashpool family by Hans Becker, Angie.
Do you have it?
Of course. David Pope accessed it recently. He was quite impressed.
Really? How recently?
Last Monday.
I'll see it tonight, then.
Done. Is that all?
Yes.
Goodbye, Angie. David Pope, her director.
Porfire said that Robin was telling people she heard voices.
Had he told Pope?
She touched a ceramic panel.
The spray grew hotter.
Why was Pope interested in Tessier Ashpool?
She touched the panel again and gasped under needles of suddenly frigid water. Inside out, outside in. The figures of that other landscape arriving soon. Too soon. Porfire was posed by the window when she entered the living room. A Maasai warrior in shoulder-padded black silk crepe and black leather sarong. The others cheered when they saw her, and Porfire turned and grinned.
"Took us by surprise," Rick Rabel said,
sprawled on the pale couch. He was effects and editing.
"Hilton figured you'd want more of a break."
"They pulled us in from all over, dear," Kelly Hickman added.
"I was in Bremen, and the Pope was up the well in full art mode, weren't you, David?"
He looked to the director for confirmation.
Pope, who was straddling one of the Louis XVI chairs backward, his arms crossed along the top of its fragile back, smiled wearily, dark hair tangled above his thin face. When Angie's schedule allowed for it, Pope made documentaries for Net Knowledge. Shortly after she'd signed with the Net, Angie participated anonymously in one of Pope's minimalist art pieces, an endless stroll across dunes of soiled pink satin under a tooled steel sky. 3 months later, the arc of her career firmly underway, an unlicensed version of the tape became an underground classic. Karen Lomas, who did Angie's infills, smiled from the chair left of Pope. To his right, Kelly Hickman, wardrobe, sat on the bleached floor beside Brian Ing, Piper's gopher-come-understudy.
"Well," Angie said, "I'm back."
"I'm sorry to have hung all of you up, but it had to be done."
There was a silence. Minute creaks from the gilt chairs. Brian Ing coughed.
"We're just glad you're back," Piper said, coming in from the kitchen with a cup of coffee in either hand.
They cheered again, somewhat self-consciously this time, then laughed.
"Where's Robin?" Angie asked.
"Mr. Lanier in London,"
Porfire said, hands on his leather-wrapped hips.
"Expected hourly," Pope said dryly, getting up and accepting a coffee from Piper. "What were you doing in orbit, David?"
Angie asked, taking the other cup.
"Hunting solitaries."
"Solitude?"
"Solitaries. Hermits."
"Angie," Hickman said, springing up,
You have to see the satin cocktail number DeVic sent last week. And I've got all of Nakamura's swimwear.
Yes, Callie, but...
But Pope had already turned to say something to Rabel.
Hey,
Hickman said, beaming with enthusiasm.
Come on.
Let's try it on. Pope spent most of the day with Piper, Karen Lomas, and Rabel discussing the results of the usher and the endless minor details of what they referred to as Angie's reinsertion. After lunch, Brian Ng went along with her to her physical, which was conducted in a private clinic in a mirror-clad compound on Beverly Boulevard. During the very brief wait in the white, plant-filled reception area, surely a matter of ritual, as though a medical appointment that involved no wait might seem incomplete, inauthentic, Angie found herself wondering, as she'd wondered many times before, why her father's mysterious legacy, the vey-vey he'd drawn in her head, had never been detected by this or any other clinic. Her father, Christopher Mitchell, had headed the hybridoma project that had allowed Moss Biolabs a virtual monopoly in the early manufacture of biochips. Turner, the man who had taken her to New York, had given her a kind of dossier on her father. A biosoft compiled by a Moss security AI. She'd accessed the dossier 4 times in as many years. Finally, one very drunken night in Greece, she'd flung the thing from the deck of an Irish industrialist's yacht after a shouting match with Bobby. She no longer recalled the cause of the fight, but she did remember the mingled sense of loss and relief as the squat little nub of memory struck the water. Perhaps her father had designed his handiwork so that it was somehow invisible to the scans of the neurotechnicians. Bobby had his own theory, one she had suspected was closer to the truth. Perhaps Legba, the Loa Beauvoir credited with almost infinite access to the cyberspace matrix, could alter the flow of data as it was obtained by the scanners, rendering the vey-vey transparent. Legba, after all, had orchestrated her debut in the industry, and the subsequent rise that had seen her eclipse Tali Isham's 15-year career as net megastar. But it had been so long since the Loa had ridden her, and now, Brigitte had said, the vey-vey had been redrawn. Hilton had continuity front ahead for you today, Ng told her as she waited.
Oh?
Public statement on your decision to go to Jamaica, praise for the methods of the clinic, the dangers of drugs, renewed enthusiasm for your work, gratitude to your audience, stock footage of the Malibu place. Continuity could generate video images of Angie, animate them with templates compiled from her stims. Viewing them induced a mild but not unpleasant vertigo, one of the rare times she was able to directly grasp the fact of her fame. A chime sounded beyond the greenery. Returning from the city, she found caterers preparing for a barbecue on the deck. She lay on the couch beneath the Valmier and listened to the surf. From the kitchen, she could hear Piper explaining the results of the physical to Pope. There was no need, really. She'd been given the cleanest possible bill of health. But both Pope and Piper were fond of detail. When Piper and Rabel put on sweaters and went out into the deck, where they stood warming their hands above the coals, Angie found herself alone in the living room with the director.
You were about to tell me, David, what you were doing up the well.
Looking for serious loners. He ran a hand back across his tangled hair. It grows out of something I wanted to do last year with intentional communities in Africa. Trouble was, when I got up there, I learned that anyone who goes that far, who'll actually live alone in orbit, is generally determined to stay that way, You were taping yourself? Interviews? No, I wanted to find people like that and talk them into recording segments themselves. Did you? No, I heard stories, though, some great stories. A tug pilot claimed there were feral children living in a mothballed Japanese drug factory. There's a whole new apocrypha out there. Really. Ghost ships, lost cities. There's a pathos in it, when you think about it. I mean, every bit of it's locked into orbit. All of it man-made, known, owned, mapped. Like watching myths take root in a parking lot. But I suppose people need that, don't they?
Yes, she said, thinking of Legba, of Maman Brigitte, the thousand candles.
I wish, though, he said, that I could have gotten through to Lady Jane. Such an amazing story. Pure Gothic.
Lady Jane?
Tessier Ashpool. Her family built Freeside Taurus. High-orbit pioneers. Continuity has a marvelous video. They say she killed her father. She's the last of the line. Money ran out years ago. She sold everything, had her place sawn off the tip of the spindle, and towed out to a new orbit.
She sat up on the couch, her knees together, fingers locked across them. Sweat trickled down across her ribs.
You don't know the story?
No, she said.
That's interesting in itself because it shows you how adept they were at obscurity. They used their money to keep themselves out of the news. The mother was Tessier, the father Ashpool. They built Freeside when there was nothing else like it. Got fantastically rich in the process, probably running a very close second to Josef Virek when Ashpool died. And of course, they'd gotten wonderfully weird in the meantime. Had taken to cloning their children wholesale.
It sounds terrible. And you tried? You did try to find her?
Well, I made inquiries. Continuity had gotten me this Becker video, and of course her orbit's in the book, but it's no good dropping by if you haven't been invited, is it? And then Hilton buzzed me to get back here and back to work. Aren't you feeling well?
Yes, I think I'll change now. Put on something warmer.
After they'd eaten, when coffee was being served, she excused herself and said goodnight. Porfire followed her to the base of the stairs. He'd stayed near her during the meal, as though he sensed her new unease. No, she thought, not new. The old. The always. The now and ever was. All the things the drug had fenced away.
Miss it, take care,
he said, too quietly for the others to hear.
I'm fine, she said. Too many people. I'm still not used to it.
He stood there looking up at her, the glow of dying coals behind his elegantly crafted, subtly inhuman skull, until she turned and climbed the stairs. She heard the helicopter come for them an hour later.
House, she said. I'll see the video from Continuity now.
As the wall screen slid down into place, she opened the bedroom door and stood for a moment at the top of the stairs, listening to the sounds of the empty house. Surf. The hum of the dishwasher. Wind buffeting the windows that faced the deck. She turned back to the screen and shivered at the face she saw there in a grainy freeze-frame headshot. Avian eyebrows arched above dark eyes. High, fragile cheekbones and a wide, determined mouth. The image expanded steadily into the darkness of an eye. Black screen. A white point growing, lengthening, becoming the tapered spindle of Freeside. Credits began to flash in German. Hans Becker, The house began, reciting the Net Library's intro critique.
Is an Austrian video artist whose hallmark is an obsessive interrogation of rigidly delimited fields of visual information. His approaches range from classical montage to techniques borrowed from industrial espionage, deep space imaging, and kino archaeology. Antarctica starts here. His examination of images of the Tessier-Ashpool family currently stands as the high point of his career. The pathologically media-shy industrial clan, operating from the total privacy of their orbital home, posed a remarkable challenge.
The white of the spindle filled the screen as the final credit vanished. An image tracked to center screen. Snapshot of a young woman in loose dark clothes. Background indistinct. Marie-France Tessier, Morocco. This wasn't the face in the opening shot, the face of invading memory. Yet it seemed to promise it, as though a larval image lay beneath the surface. The soundtrack wove atonal filaments through strata of static and indistinct voices as the image of Marie-France was replaced by a formal monochrome portrait of a young man in a starched wing collar. It was a handsome face, finely proportioned, but very hard somehow, and in the eyes a look of infinite boredom. John Harness Ashpool, Oxford. Yes, she thought, and I've met you many times. I know your story, though I'm not allowed to touch it. But I really don't think I like you at all, do I, Mr. Ashpool?
Chapter 13. Catwalk. The catwalk groaned and swayed. The stretcher was too wide for the walk's handrails, so they had to keep it chest high as they inched across. Gentry at the front, with his gloved hands clamped around the rails on either side of the sleeper's feet. Slick had the heavy end, the head, with the batteries and all that gear. He could feel Cherry creeping along behind him. He wanted to tell her to get back, that they didn't need her weight on the walk. But somehow he couldn't. Giving Gentry Kid Africa's bag of drugs had been a mistake. He didn't know what was in the derm Gentry'd done. He didn't know what had been in Gentry's bloodstream to begin with. Whatever. Gentry'd gone bare wires crazy, and now they were out here on the fucking catwalk, 20 meters over factory's concrete floor, and Slick was ready to weep with frustration, to scream. He wanted to smash something, anything, but he couldn't let go of the stretcher. And Gentry's smile, lit up by the glow of the bio readout taped to the foot of the stretcher, as Gentry took another step backward across the catwalk.
Oh, man, Cherry said, her voice like a little girl's. This is just seriously fucked.
Gentry gave the stretcher a sudden, impatient tug, and Slick almost lost his grip.
Gentry, Slick said, I think you better think twice about this.
Gentry had removed his gloves. He held a pair of optic jumpers in either hand, and Slick could see the splitter fittings trembling.
I mean, Kid Africa's heavy, Gentry. You don't know what you're messing with. You mess with him.
This was not, strictly speaking, true. The kid being, as far as Slick knew, too smart to value revenge. But who the hell knew what Gentry was about to mess with anyway?
I'm not messing with anything, Gentry said, approaching the stretcher with the jumpers.
Listen, buddy, Cherry said. You interrupt his input, you maybe kill him. His autonomic nervous system will go tits up. Why don't you just stop him?
She asked Slick.
Why don't you just knock him on his ass?